You only get one life. I repeat, you only get one life. You do not get one life to live for yourself and another to make your parents or your partner or your best friend happy, or at least keep them quiet. You only get the one, and once it's gone, it's gone. If the process of weaving words together satisfies you in ways nothing else does, because you're a writing geek, you must do it. You must do it, or you risk exuding the same bitterness, the same resentment of those who tried to stop you.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with writer and teacher Stephanie Vanderslice about her book, The Geek's Guide to the Writing Life, an instructional memoir for prose writers, published by Bloomsbury Academic.
Like I said, it won't be easy. Despite receiving moral and material support, for which I'm grateful, there have also been many, many times in my life when I simply had to turn a deaf ear to people who did not think I could succeed, who pressed me to choose something else, to become a lawyer, a pediatrician, an elementary school teacher. I was polite but steadfast in my refusal to consider anything else, focusing instead on how to support myself and my family while staying true to my goals.
Stephanie Vanderslice, Writing Geeks, and Other Interesting Phenomena on Arts and Letters. From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with Stephanie Vanderslice about her instructional memoir for prose writers, which captures the essence of being a writing teacher who writes with her students.
Candlelight to solder is the sparky to light the way to the new world.
We'll learn about her life as a working writer.
You don't have to be cool to be a writer. You do not have to be anointed. And I am living proof.
About surviving writing programs.
But what was that thing that guy in the beard at the front of the room said as you were walking out? Something about the global MFA? What even is a global MFA?
About how to think about getting an agent.
And there are actual places online that you can find agents who represent exactly what you're writing and also who represent more first-time writers.
And about what this means for the rest of us geeks, just staring at our blank screens or trying to put pen to paper.
A party lost in orbit, course it's hard to know if they'd find a life or drown.
Stephanie Vanderslice, Professor of Creative Writing and Director of the Arkansas Writing MFA Workshop at the University of Central Arkansas, and Chairperson of the Creative Writing Studies Organization. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
We're really happy to have you here. Let's just talk a little bit about the title. It's so fun, The Geek's Guide to the Writing Life. And it's funny because you're a geek, but you're kind of a cool geek. Because you're kind of on the inside. You've been writing for a really long time.
I'm on the inside of the outside.
Yeah, and you give such good suggestions, and you really genuinely want to help. And what comes through in this more than anything is how much you love to teach. So I think this is a teaching book in as many ways.
I think you're right.
Tell us why you wanted to put the personal stuff in here, because you get a lot of guides that are kind of straightforward, or you get the real personal ones. This is a kind of hybrid.
You know, writing ties into our lives and stories tie into our lives. You know, when I first started blogging years ago, that I would get the most hits on posts that were a little more personal, which always surprised me. What I started doing is writing so much about the writing process itself. And then I started getting mail from people saying they were enjoying it. So that made me, you know, want to write more about the struggles that I was going through as a writer.
They don't go chasing the stars around you. They just go chasing my heart. They fill me up with a fallen fable. The broken gave me the egghead star.
And then I realized, well, what am I? I'm really a writing geek. That's what this is. I'm a writing geek. So then I started to just title every piece The Geek's Guide to the Writing Life, and then whatever the topic was. I just started to do it. What it really is being steady. And whatever you're working on, if you write an hour a day, that thing will be in your mind the other 23 hours of the day. You'll be thinking about it.
So fast I fell from the gazing side eye, but I'm gonna go it alone.
I think in writing, especially binge writing, it works for some people, but I don't even think that that's really the case.
I don't either. Because you don't want to go back to it.
Right, exactly.
It's like a bad hangover.
Exactly.
Over now and on the ground. Oh, it's been now, it's all around, and I'll fade.
An hour a day doesn't feel onerous. It doesn't feel like, oh my gosh, I have 6 hours ahead of me.
Right.
And writing is hard. So an hour a day, anyone can do that.
Yeah, we all have an hour. You know, when you have family, that's time. So what have been some of the negotiating points there? The practical advice of being able to negotiate an artistic world with a family.
It's
there aren't a lot of how-to books there.
There aren't. And I would say the number one thing is to have a partner who's fully on board. That's everything. And I write about that in the book.
Well, they got married in a fever. I felt my life was all right. That's all right.
Blogging. For some people, the idea of eventually having children is non-negotiable. I would be one of those children. Legend has it that at 7, I informed my mother that if I wasn't married by a certain age, I would adopt anyway because I was having children no matter what. Keep in mind that I made this proclamation in the late 70s when having a husband and children was still the official script. Keep in mind the idea behind why I might even need to adopt was still a few years off, along with a more solid understanding of the science of conception. But I was quite serious. There were two things I have always known I wanted in life: to have a family and to write. And my husband is fully on board. It wasn't like, these are your kids, you wanted them. They're our kids, and he is as involved a parent as I am, and he always has been. Beginning our family at this point introduced certain obligations and definitely made some aspects of both of our writing lives more difficult, but we wouldn't have done anything differently. In our son's first year, my husband and I both finished creative critical dissertations, started to publish, and probably applied to close to 300 academic jobs between us. It was completely exhausting. You know, when someone needs to eat, they need to eat, or they need, you know, and so especially when they're younger, there's things they demand. And so you have, you know, by being living, breathing human beings, they're not that my children were demanding. And sometimes you may not get as much done writing wise. But I wouldn't trade that miraculous first year with our son for anything in the world. As luck would have it, he was a preternaturally good baby who slept, I am not kidding, 12 hours a night from 2 months on, which did allow us to get some work done. Lest this fact make you want to stare poison darts at my husband and me, however, be reassured that our second child utterly made up for his brother's somnolence by an unwillingness to miss a single moment, even if it meant poking his own eyes with his tiny fingers and spitting his pacifier across the room in desperate attempts to keep himself awake. I was also very engaged, and I think my husband would say the same thing, in being aware of their growing. I mean, it's such a miraculous time. But then they start growing away from you, and then you can return to your own work.
It comes and it follows and floods the cargo bay. It comes and it follows, and I just can't pray. It comes and it follows, so we would settle down. It comes and it follows us home.
You never know what's rubbing off on your kids at all, but when my son wrote his college applications, his essay was about, I know how to work hard. I watch my parents. You know, they work early in the morning. And I was like, whoa, he noticed it. But it gave him permission to make that choice himself.
And so many parents don't. It's nice that you gave him permission to be an artist.
And you don't know that you're doing it until you've done it.
Well, they've been singing in the ether. And now I'd like to take flight. I feel like.
Let's continue our conversation with writer Stephanie Vanderslice about her book, The Geek's Guide to the Writing Life, an instructional memoir for prose writers. An MFA is a Master's in
right,
Fine
Masters
Arts.
Right, Master's in Fine Arts.
That tends to be the terminal degree, and
right.
I hate that word, but the terminal degree for creative writers if they want to teach.
Exactly.
And what would a think piece about an MFA be?
Well, a lot. Most of the ones that you read are very centered on whatever that writer's experience was.
The outer rim rose the overwhelm all through the inside. As all the charred debris lay on the outside.
I've actually spent a lot of time studying different MFAs. You know, that was actually an area of research.
You
for
did a
me.
Book on it.
Yeah, I did. So it annoys me when somebody says, well, and in our MFA program, we study literature this way, and so everyone must study literature this way. And I think, no, actually, that's not true.
Sword and thought that time would save us, time could save us, time would make a time to save.
Think piece. How to write an MFA think piece, a brief introduction to the genre. Are you thinking of writing a detailed, critical response to your experience with an MFA program, studying in one or teaching in one? Maybe you've just read about the phenomena and decided, what the hell, I'll throw in my 2 cents. Perhaps these guidelines will help. First and foremost, with the exception of the 1 or 2 essays you might reference, avoid the internet. I cannot emphasize this enough. Specifically, take care to construct your argument as if Google had never been invented. And the search terms creative writing programs, and higher education existed utterly outside your lexicon. Second, but perhaps just as important, if your experience has been with a famous, iconic MFA program, don't worry, it's less incumbent on you to investigate what is going on at the other programs, as it is a fact generally accepted in U.S. culture that whatever is going on in those programs represents whatever is happening at the literally hundreds of full residency or low residency programs across the nation.
Ate it late last week, we're swallowed inside. but for the outside.
Didn't a famous writer, you think it was even a woman, once say that the problem with creative writing programs was that they didn't stifle enough writers? You are sure you heard that somewhere. You could look it up, but you've decided to swear off Google again. It's nothing but trouble. Cutting back on all those programs would be a place to start. Do they really need every single one? There should be a quota on writers, or some of these programs should become more rigorous. And more literature courses, courses where you have to look stuff up. At least the people in those programs should. What are students even doing in those places? I don't actually know, to tell you the truth, but I know what they should be doing, getting back to basics.
That's hilarious. And it's funny because the persona here won't look anything up.
Exactly.
But suggests everybody should look big.
Exactly.
Let's turn the outside around. We'll turn the outside around. Let's turn the outside around. On another plane where your course is never found.
If you were to pick one little section to help maybe answer
young
writers or older writers' questions, what section would that be?
I would like cast a wide net. Once you've developed your craft and revised until your eyeballs bleed, you're ready to start submitting your work. If you've been committed to the practice of reading and knowing what's going on in the literary world, hopefully you've begun to envision a list of outlets that publish the kinds of work you write. That's a good place to start, but it's important to add to this list by routinely skimming and subscribing to calls for submissions at sites like New Pages, Duotrope, Aerogram Writers, SubMishmash, Bisubmittable, the CRWR Ops listserv, and in the U.S. in the classified sections of Poets and Writers magazine and the Association of Writers and Writing Programs Chronicle magazine. Once you read about a publication that sounds interesting in one of these classifieds, do a little more research. Look at their website. See if you can read a sample publication or two, or at least some samples of what they publish, or a mission statement to get a sense if you write what they're looking for. And then send it out. Multiple times, multiple copies. Translated, this means submitting your work simultaneously unless a magazine or journal tells you otherwise. Just be sure, if your work is accepted at one publication, let the others know right away so they don't waste their time considering it.
Wonderful. I like this bit about the multiple submissions, too. But you'd say that ethically, it's okay.
I think
as
it's
long
okay.
as you let people know, as soon as you know.
As long as you let them know, as soon as you know. And they also, if they do that, to me, they're saying, I'm going to get back to you quickly.
Pretty quickly. So let's talk a little bit about some of the practical advice here, because there's such good practical advice.
If staring at the sun would render you less blind, you'd be spreading high as a tree, yeah. Stabilizers on and all the signals lost, still I think I know where I'd be, yeah.
I particularly like the bit about getting an agent. I really thought that was wonderful. Just some general suggestions for people.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's not talked about much, but it's actually a pretty linear process.
On another plane.
You have something that you've worked on. It's very good. And in the sense that you've revised it till within an inch of its life. You don't feel you can take it any further. That's when you're ready to start looking for an agent. And there are actual places online that you can find agents who represent exactly what you're writing and also who represent more first-time writers.
And what I liked most about it was how you talked about treating it like a job.
Right.
You are researching them. Learning about them, who they represent, who they've represented, what kind of work they do.
Once I decided on the agents I was interested in, I actually would read interviews with them, and then I would touch on things that they had said in my query letter. Like, you know, if I found someone who had played softball when they were young, well, I happen to have written this, you know, piece about a young girl who integrates her softball league. I think it would be perfect for this agent. You know, I might mention that. You're not trying to pull one over on them. You're trying to connect with them and say, there's something about you that I think connects with this story. if you can narrow that field and connect with people, and the great thing is all this stuff is out there on the internet. 30 years ago, it wasn't. Right. But now you can find all this stuff out. I follow certain agents on Twitter, which is funny because what I learned from doing that was how hard they work. These are incredibly hardworking people.
Right.
And people who are very, you know, who actually read submissions in their spare time. You learn a lot about them, you know, and that they're human.
On another plane, I could see it now. On another plane.
And you talk about how it's like a kind of 10-to-1 ratio.
It's a 10-to-1 ratio.
Like so, you send out 100 pieces, you might get 10 responses, and of that 10,
one.
This is a little less oriented in competition than it is in help. So cool and uncool writers help each other.
Competitiveness is not that sustaining. And I want to see my students succeed. To me, success in a student is that they write for the rest of their lives. They don't give it up and they find some satisfaction with it. They get to share it with other people. But the people who are the most competitive over the time that I've seen don't stay with it.
Right, and you call them the egoists. These are the folks, they're so self-conscious in one end that they just don't feel like they have anything to learn. They may be excellent, but you say they're the ones who don't typically grow.
Right, exactly.
Because they cannot think about revising in ways that are helpful to themselves.
Yes, or taking the risk of failure even. I mean, to grow, you really have to fail and you have to be able to take risks.
Come into the world and break me down. Come into the world and break me down. You're living your life in the sun. Praying to God I don't run.
And you write a chapter called Be
Teachable.
And it's more important to be teachable. And by teachable, you mean being open to people's suggestions, even if they're things you don't think are good. Not necessarily doing them, but just being open to... Those are the writers that succeed.
Absolutely.
The ones who don't are the ones who just have a sense of a vision that's only theirs. They might succeed in the sense that they finish something, but if you actually want to be read,
you have
to listen.
Yeah, and if you want to grow, because I think those people just want to have their own view of the world confirmed. And, you know, there's other views, and the more you can learn about that, I think the more you can connect with readers and grow as a writer.
And I get it. I mean, it's a scary place because criticism can whale you.
Right, and it never stops. I mean, even when you're not a student anymore, there's so much you can learn.
Come into the world and break me down. Come into the world and break me down. You're living your life in the sun. Praying to God I don't run.
And of course, writing is just substitute for anything.
Anything. Before we part, let me remind you once more, the writer's life isn't just for a select few, but something available to anyone with the will to pursue it, because as you've discovered, if you've read to this point, such a life, while it has its compensations, is not easy. Ultimately, while some of these rewards will keep you going as a writer, they are not the reasons why we write. We write because we must, because we have something to say, because we're writing geeks. We write because we're the kinds of people who have to get ideas, stories, out of our heads and onto the page, or in whatever format the words take. This is what makes us writers. No one has the right to tell you differently.
That's beautiful.
It's all my hopes of the quest to find silver, until you finally go to find what it really means.
let's just end with the coda, finally don't give up. Do you think that's the takeaway?
Yes, absolutely.
Because it's not about publishing. It's about not giving up and what you learn from the introspection and of doing it. Again, this book is about anything.
Anything
that matters.
Any kind of thing that you want to do that matters. Yeah, you can translate it.
I mean, if it matters to them, why do they give it up?
I think they think that somehow they're not worthy when they experience failure.
When you're living and you're less than alive, it's all the same now. Take the giving and the grit falling by, it's all the same. And another for the ones that you sigh and want to lay down, when they're with you at the end of the line.
Failure is part of the process, because I don't think we're a culture that celebrates failure. It's part of everything. It's part of succeeding. So people fail and think, oh, I must not be cut out for this.
Mm-hmm. And school mitigates against
school
it. I mean, right? An F is when we learn the most. Not
exactly.
Necessarily, unless we don't do anything. If
it
you're
does.
Trying and you're continually failing, you're learning a whole lot more than if you know everything and you get the A.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we are a culture that really prizes the end result instead of the steps to it.
When the steps are what? The only thing we got. Because
exactly.
As you said, we only really have time.
Right, right. I mean, it's really about the steps.
Well, look at all the eyes you see. Just hoping someone defines them. I can't find them.
Finally,
don't give up.
While book publishing can seem a capricious, almost arbitrary business, that may be, in part, its beauty. You don't have to take failure in this realm entirely personally. If you believe in something you've written, truly believe in it, and if you've received encouraging responses to the work as a whole, there's no reason you shouldn't keep trying to bring it to readers. Besides, if you give up too soon, you'll never know if you were on the verge of finding your champion. The publishing world is full of stories of writers who succeeded after their umpteenth rejection, from Margaret Mitchell to Stephen King, from Nabokov to J.K. Rowling. The next one really could be you, but only if you keep going.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. A super big thank you to Adam Simon of Simon Sound for producing and mastering the program and for writing all of the original music in it. You're the coolest geek I know.
Candlelight to solder is the sparky to light the way to the new.
A special thanks to Mary Ellen Cubitt for the story editing advice. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to Stephanie Vanderslice for her sagacity, her actorial pursuits, and her declamations on writing and geekery. For Arts and Letters, let's heed these words from John W. Gardner. We teach who we are.